Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we'll discuss the battle at the bottom, big wins for both Leeds and Watford. You'll also find out who Alison Rudd was talking about when she said this.
Odd appointment after peculiar appointment at a poorly run club.
We'll also discuss events at Stamford Bridge. Should questions on Saudi Arabia be directed at the Newcastle boss, Eddie Howe? We'll discuss Cristiano Ronaldo being the greatest goal scoring ever and give you some reasons to be cheerful as well. This is The Game. Hello again, welcome back to The Game. I'm Hugh Woozencroft alongside Matt Dickinson and Alison Rudd on this week's episode of The Game. It was an interesting weekend in the Premier League. I like the idea of so many games on a Sunday. Just remember that for all my blackout arguments. You know, Sunday wasn't too bad, was it? Anyway, huge games at the bottom of the table. That's what we're going to start with. And in particular, Elland Road, a first win for manager Jesse Marsh. Leeds beating Norwich 2-1. A very eventful game. Leeds now 4 points clear of the relegation zone. Joe Geldhart with a 95th minute winner after Kenny McLean had equalised for Norwich after 92 minutes. But how critical could this win be in Leeds' season? What do you think, Alison?
Still reeling from the fact that Jesse Marsh said he'll remember this result on his deathbed. I mean, get a grip.
He's enthusiastic.
If he finds a late winner against Norwich, something he's going to be.
He doesn't like the comparisons with Ted Lasso, and then he comes out with that.
His defensiveness about Ted Lasso. I couldn't understand though. I mean, you know, who didn't want Ted Lasso in the charge of their team? Mm. I mean, the feel-good manager of all time. I mean, anyway, and they make a nice TV show out of it that might be more interesting than all the guff Amazon ones that we see. So,
I find Leeds now have become funnier than Ted Lasso because I still get the sense that the Leeds fans would be happier losing under Bielsa than scraping a win against Norwich under a new American owner who is the exact opposite of... is so opposite to Bielsa, it's untrue. I mean, football does this. I mean, the golden rule of football is that, you know, a manager is sacked, the next manager is always different. And it happens with the, you know, England managers. They seesaw. So, you know, you go from high promotional to very serious, English to non-English and so on. And it happens at club level as well. So you've gone from a man who refused to speak English, who sat on a bucket and somehow was treated as a god. And then you've got an American who you do feel would talk forever and ever if allowed to. And his hyperbole is ridiculous. I mean, I'll remember this on my deathbed, which makes him sound like he's slightly out of his depth. And I do worry about the games to come, that he needs to keep a lid on it, really, and realise this is what it was, which was a very, very close shave with some... You know, it's what's promising is that the players seem to be giving him everything, and he's going to get Bamford back from injury is fantastic. But that would have been fantastic under Bielsa, wouldn't it? The team have bought into him. They're not on strike. But I do feel the atmosphere at Elland Road isn't the same. So it's strange. They're in more need than ever of the fans to be that sort of, you know, so totally, totally behind them. They create this incredible roar of support. Didn't used to get despondent when they went behind. But now I feel that you know, I mean, Martin Hardy was there for us, and he commented on how there's the complete sense of deflation when Norwich pulled a goal back, and that wouldn't have happened when Bielsa was there. They would have just kept on roaring. So there's this sort of, he's got to be, it's a difficult path for him to navigate, I feel, Marsh, and I just don't think he's helped himself by this narrow 2-1 defeat over the only team we can say for certain does look like it's going down, is in some way the amazing miracle he's painting it as and has affected him so deeply.
But it was a game they needed to win.
Exactly. Six straight defeat. And you know, to be fair to him, you know, when you throw on a teenager with, you know, a few kicks left in the game and he pops up with the winner like that, then yeah. I'm giving him a bit more slack on the excitability. No, it was huge. I mean, it was huge. It's, you know, we bang on about momentum, and Leeds's momentum was you know, downward plummet. And that could be the most important goal that they've scored all season.
In a way, going away from home might help them as well, because you did. I was at Elland Road last week, and you did feel this sense of brilliant support at the start of the game, feeling like, you know, this is Leeds. We need to back the team completely. And then things going very, very sour and the team getting booed off at the end of the game. Marcelo Bielsa's name being chanted, abuse being directed towards the director of football, Victor Orta, who was in tears at the end of the game against Norwich as well. And you felt this very strange, you know, can we all keep it together here, guys? There are still some games to come. It wasn't the final day of the season, and you still might be going down. And I still worry for them. I feel like people took a lot from this weekend's results as an indication that maybe some teams have some life in them that maybe they don't. And we'll come to a couple of those in a minute. But I did want to talk about Patrick Bamford, who is back for Leeds, looks pretty tired, worked his socks off. He's been out for a long time. I know he made his return in their previous match, but he started this game. And he made a big difference because they created a huge number of chances off his link-up play. Is his presence, Matt, going to be enough to keep Leeds up?
Well, he's a huge option. We've seen that for Leeds over the last couple of years. So, I mean, in itself, to get him back at a key point, we're talking about, you know, not just tactical options, but bringing a different mood to it as well. And as you say, I mean, he played well. He was involved. He obviously ran out of steam quickly, taken off at half time. But I think it's to have a senior player, have a striker back. I mean, often when I'm looking at who the teams are going to go down, you're looking at, generally I look at the attacking option, just see who's got goals in them to get out of trouble, because, you know, wins at this stage account so hugely. And Bamford, just by their, you know, whether he's scoring himself or not, but as you say, bringing a different mode to the Leeds attack, I think is key. But, you know, having said all that pooky chance at the end, you know, I mean, it was complete, you know, heart and mouth moment, and that goes a foot to the side, and we're talking a very, very different story.
Mm. Also, Rodrigo's goal, the first goal, was offside. Patrick Bamford makes the run, stretches the defensive line. He's off, even though he doesn't interfere with play, although I do think he did run towards the general area that the ball was landing in. The defender heads it back into open play. Dan James wins the second ball. It drops to Rodrigo's feet and he hits it into the back of the net. But that should be offside. The defender would not have headed the ball, wouldn't have gone for the ball, had he known that Bamford was offside. But because there's an element of doubt, he heads it. That's offside.
And it's delayed offsides, which is infuriates me week after week. But.
And the same is true of Harry Maguire's own goal, because he wouldn't have cut that ball out if Romero wasn't in the middle in the game between Spurs and Manchester United. It goes into the back of the net, but he only extends his leg for the ball to stop it from going to that player, and that player is offside.
Yeah, no,
I
absolutely.
Believe
you
that
need,
is offside.
You need all the defenders to have their brains attached to a great big computer, which is then at Stockley Park, and they can work out what they were actually feeling and thinking, and then you will know if someone's offside or not, because if the defender is having to consider them, then they're offside. If the defender hasn't noticed them or has decided not to bother with them, then it's onside.
Still, a big win for Leeds this weekend, and Jesse Marsh possibly breathing new life into their chances of staying in the Premier League. Elsewhere, big win for Watford away from home against Southampton. 2-1 win. They move on to 22 points. They're level with Everton, who are just above them on goal difference. And we'll come to Everton shortly. But Roy Hodgson, do we think he's going to get Watford out of this?
Well, if he dressed as smartly as that every week, then absolutely, he looked like a retired colonel who'd just come to tell everybody, well, this is what's what. And I've had enough of bad defending and not being attacking enough. We're going to do it properly, chaps. And I'm going to wear a blazer and it's fine. And everyone was, I mean, you could see Hasenhüttl was like, oh, my goodness, I look a real mess compared to Roy. And he just couldn't manage them anymore. I mean, I'm being sarcastic. And yet there might be something in it. I did feel like it felt like Roy was like metaphorically rolling up his sleeves and saying, right, come on, we are not a bad team here. And they're not a bad team. They have some great players. They just need to be organised properly. And that's what Roy does well. So that is why I will say, yes, I think they possibly do have what it takes. Because I think they've got, as my colleague Matt has just said, you look at their attacking options. They have fantastic attacking options. And in the dugout, you need someone who can rein it all in and make sure they don't go too berserk. And that is what Roy is. You know, he's the voice of reason. So I think they do. And they have lots of six-pointers coming up. They seem to be only playing teams in and around them. So, yeah, I think they could just do it.
Do you want them to stay up? See, that's the big question for me. Do we want Watford to stay in the Premier League, or should they be punished for their chopping and changing of managers?
Oh, that is so interesting. It's so interesting because this is going to be a podcast really about ownership at the end of it, isn't it? And Watford's owners are not engaged in sports washing, but they are engaged in being hyper trigger happy and ruthless, and we have become a bit bored of it. If I want Watford to stay up, it, for two reasons, I think they do have players who can score great goals. And when they play well, they are really good fun to watch. They are entertaining. And I'm glad about that because when Roy came in, everyone said it's going to be very boring now. He's not a boring manager. He knows how to... He manages flair players very well, actually. And also, I'd like Watford to stay up because I think it's... You know, we're starting to talk about Roy's legacy, given he's in his mid-70s. I don't want this to be his last job, where he goes down with a club that pin their hopes on his abilities to keep them there. I think it'd be great for a very, very long, illustrious career for him to show all the newbies how it's done.
Beautiful, beautiful. There is a team we know you want to stay up, though, and that's Brentford.
Well, they are staying up. It's not a question.
8 points clear of the relegation zone. Back-to-back wins. They beat 19th placed Burnley 2-0. Christian Eriksen's relationship with Ivan Toney seems to have struck the right chord immediately.
Yeah, and they're made for each other. It's, you know, you need somebody who... you need an intelligent centre-forward who, you know, is hungry for good passing and can judge the flight of the ball well, has the physical presence to intimidate defenders, very single-minded about getting to the ball, scoring, making the runs to win penalties, whatever it is. And then you have the delicacy of Eriksen, who enjoys knowing someone's going to respond to his passing in that way. What is it? Is it sort of like... It was so predictable in a way, and I'm pleased. I mean, Eriksen is not going to save Brentford from relegation because of his physicality in the middle of the pitch or his tracking back necessarily, but he can slot into Brentford and they don't lose anything because they are, everyone around him is particularly hard working. They give it everything, so they can absorb the fact he's not, you know, hugely important in their defensive shape, which allows him space and time to be creative, that's what he's doing from set pieces. He is actually statistically the best in the Premier League if you could take his whole career into account. So he's delivering from set pieces, and also in play his reading of the game is first class, and around him he has players who are just hungry for that quality. I just cannot see Brentford not staying up.
So we can safely say then, I think, that Brentford are going to be safe. So we'll leave them out of our relegation chats between here and the end of the season. But one team that's going to be firmly ensconced in them, I think, is Everton. Matt, they lost at home to Wolves this weekend. For some people, that was a surprising result. For me, not at all, really. I'm not expecting much from Everton at the moment. How worried should their fans be right now? And did you expect more from Frank Lampard in this job?
Well, I can tell you exactly how worried they are because the Everton contingent from my family were around at the weekend, and at one stage we were sort of joking about QPR v Everton in the Championship next season, but obviously now QPR being promoted, we're actually going to pass them as we head up. But no, I mean, they are genuinely worried and every right to be, and that was even before this result, and that was even before looking at the fixture list. When you look at, we've obviously got the form table in the game this morning, which shows Everton firmly rooted to the bottom, 4 points from 11 matches. Then you look at they're playing Newcastle, who obviously we know are playing well at the moment. Then in the league, they've got West Ham away, tough game, Man United at home, the Mersey Derby, Chelsea, Leicester away. I mean, you could look at those and think, well, they could easily lose all of those. I mean, it's you would not, on current form, they will. So, it wasn't hopeless. Richarlison has a couple of great chances. Richarlison, I thought, looked, it wasn't a team that was giving up, but obviously, certainly goal scoring confidence is rock bottom. Calvert-Lewin still was obviously absent. And, Frank Lampard is a manager that we still don't know how good he is. And that's, I think if you're looking for reasons to be, they'll turn it around, or, they'll get out of this, Frank's as much of a question mark as anything over this. This is uncharted territory for him as well. So, you look at the squad and think, yes, they should stay up. They can get Calvert-Lewin back. You think back to that issue of, is a team, got the tools to get out of this? Well, very clearly they have, but the defence remains prone to, there are very few of those defenders that I think are, I was going to say, top half Premier League. Some of them I'm not even sure are Premier League. And I think they'll stay up, but I would be very, very worried. And I think it's just, Mashiri is reaping what he showed with just colossal misjudgments pretty much every step of the way.
It was a very peculiar appointment, Frank Lampard, really. And who did Frank Lampard bring in? He brought in Donny van de Beek and Dele Alli. They're not, with all due respect, they are not top of your shopping list if you're fighting relegation, those two players. They're just not. And Dele Alli just seems to make these sort of cameo appearances and not do very much. And Donny is adequate, but he's having to get used to a new club, and in effect, he's having to get used to the Premier League. He played so little for Manchester United. I'm not having a go at the individual players, but it's indicative of what Lampard thought he was doing at Everton, which was bringing creativity. And Lampard's philosophy is front foot football, getting the ball forward quickly. He wants it to be attractive. Doesn't like too much possession, get the ball forward, let's be entertaining. They're not in the right place to be able to be thinking like this. This is about making tough decisions, picking players who are tough, forgetting about style, making sure it's about grinding out wins and tapping into the fantastic atmosphere you can get at Goodison, but it's also an atmosphere that turns quickly. And the fact they're now losing at home as well as away from home, I mean, where do you go from there? It's odd appointment after peculiar appointment at a poorly run club. That's right.
Not to dwell on it too much, they might stay up, but if they were to go down, Everton, are we looking at like another Leeds United?
I mean, you're certainly looking at a financial car crash that would be up there with the worst of, hitting a brick wall at speed that we've seen. I mean, they're just not a club that will have had this even relegation even on their agenda. I mean, the Mashiri promise was to turn this into one of the great, I think, was it Hollywood clubs of the Northwest that he said, this was meant to be a team that was, you don't appoint, you don't throw squillions of pounds until Carlo Ancelotti says, oh, all right then, in the expectation they're going to get relegated soon after. So no, it would be horrendous. And this is obviously, they've got all the problems of the Usmanov tie-up, which they're, reaping the problems of that. And to be honest, the lack of transparency on that is still, I think, raises some huge questions. We know that they're, shall we say, been very close to the wind on sustainability. So yeah, it's their problems are stacked extremely high, and yeah, this is real tightrope stuff for them now for the rest of the season.
Probably the most vital team in many ways that needs to stay in the Premier League.
They're the least equipped to you know, they're the most exposed of all. You know, if Burnley, Norwich and Watford go down, you know, it's you know, obviously colossally disappointing, and you know, as we know, takes some big readjustments, but they're, you know, they know how to handle that. Everton would be, you know, it's a full-blown crisis.
We'll see exactly how this relegation battle goes from here, but it was an interesting weekend down there. Plenty still to come on the Game podcast. We'll be talking about Chelsea and Newcastle, Cristiano Ronaldo, and we'll be giving you some reasons to be cheerful. But remember, if you're enjoying the podcast, rate us, leave us a review, and make sure you're subscribed. The Times chief sports correspondent Matt Lawton joins us next for the latest on what's been an ever-moving story. Of course, that huge news last week that saw Chelsea's owner Roman Abramovich sanctioned by the UK government over alleged links to the Russian president following the country's invasion of Ukraine. Of course, those links Abramovich denies. Matt, let's get an update, though, on what's happening. The short-term prospects for Chelsea. Over the weekend, we've heard so much from their fans who are very, very worried about the situation. Is there to be a new owner? Who will it be and when?
Well, the first thing that's got to happen is that the government have got to issue this second licence. Nothing can happen until then. It's, you know, people keep talking about, for instance, Abramovich has given the green light to sell the club. Well, now, hang on a minute. He's not in a position to do that anymore. It's up to the government to issue this licence. It will be heavily restricted in the sense that it will provide the government with oversight of the process. But that's what's got to happen first, Hugh, and that will happen, I'm pretty sure, this week. Tom Roddy spoke to the club yesterday when he was at Stamford Bridge, and they are hopeful too that it will happen this week. It's got to. I think everybody, the government included, wants to see this process get completed. In terms of who's going to buy it, it's really difficult. It's been a very unusual process because the people that certainly are viewed by some as the favourites, the Todd Boehly group, they've been the most vocal from the very beginning, and that's very unusual for this kind of process. Normally, it's completely out of left field. The people that buy these sort of football clubs don't say anything. Even the Saudis, when they bought Newcastle, didn't say anything until it had happened. And yet, these people, you know, one minute it's Nick Candy speaking, the next minute it's the Todd Boehly group, the next minute it's a different consortium in America. The fact of the matter is there are some seriously wealthy people that are hovering because they can all sense there's a deal to be done here. They can all sense that the European champions, the World Club champions, are there to be bought at a knockdown price. So you can see why there's a lot of interest. I'm loath to predict who's actually going to end up winning.
The funds, we've heard from Petr Cech at Chelsea. Are there concerns that staff won't be paid at the club and players?
I think there's definitely a problem because when you're suddenly cut off from your main income revenue, which is the owner, Roman Abramovich, worth £9 billion, you've suddenly got an issue. We broke the story on Friday night that they'd had their credit cards frozen. And I think what that tells you is the way that the business kind of operates, that was a problem. Because when I spoke to, I've got to give the credit to Steve Swinford, our political editor, who got the story, and he called me and said, could I check it at the Chelsea end? So when I spoke to Chelsea, they were basically saying, this is a problem. This is going to make it even harder for us to run the club day to day. So without being too simplistic about it, you can imagine they do literally pay for stuff on credit cards, and then the owner clears it at the end of the month. I don't know whether he rings or he does it on internet banking or whatever, but that's the way they operate. And suddenly having those cards frozen, essentially their line of credit blocked, because you know banks do this when there's something like this. When you've got sanctions being imposed by the government, the banks panic's probably not the right word, but the banks certainly do react and in a very cautious way. So they suddenly think, well, hang on a minute, if the guy with all the money has had all his assets frozen, how are they going to pay their credit card bills? And I'm assuming it isn't just 80 quid's worth of petrol for the team bus. It's big expenses on those cards. This is a football club that has a turnover of, you know, hundreds of millions. It's a problem, and so you can see why they are. Yes, there was a little bit of gallows humour yesterday in terms of, you know, Cech and Thomas Tuchel offering to drive the bus, but it's not far off being that kind of situation, unless they very quickly move on and have new owners.
There were conversations taking place between Chelsea and the government, though, to loosen the restrictions over them a little bit. They want a little bit more space to operate, and maybe that might mean they could bring some money in. Do we know how far those discussions have gone?
Well, not very far, because the fact of the matter is when they announced the slight amendments on Saturday, the only thing they really relaxed was how much they can spend on a match day, and that they increased it from £500,000 to £900,000. Now, the point with that was really the only reason the government backed down on that was because it was a safety issue, because Chelsea were making the point that, hang on a minute, if we've got 28,000, 40,000 people in the ground, we need more than £500,000 to pay for all the stewarding, the police, all that kind of stuff. And so the government relented on that, but that means they're spending more money. That doesn't solve the problem of income coming in. One of the big things, and there were a lot of there was a lot of confusion around tickets, and it was you know, well, why don't they just give the tickets away or donate the money to charity? But when you speak to Chelsea, they go, no. The reason we want to be able to sell tickets beyond our current season ticket holders, it's because that's about £600,000 a game, and they need that revenue. And the fact of the matter is, even though they sat there for 2 days with the government on Thursday and Friday, well, government officials, we should say, DCMS officials, the fact is they haven't backed down on that.
Matt, I mean, it always strikes me as the big question here, which I don't know how easy is to answer, is obviously we know that Roman Abramovich had an asking price value in mind for the club. We also know that he was talking about setting up this charity. But how now does that get unpicked in the sense of, you know, as you say, if the government are controlling the asset, then do they maintain that asking price? Do they put that money themselves towards a charity? Does Roman Abramovich literally have to just accept that this will be done and he just has to sort of approve whatever deal they can make with a buyer?
Yeah, I think the asking price, I think most people think, is unrealistic. He wanted 3 billion. That was certainly the number that the club were quite openly quoting when this whole process started. And I think really the tactics employed by the Rain Group has been to, which is this bank in New York, this merchant bank in New York, is to create a bidding war. You know, I don't think it's any coincidence that we are getting to hear about all the different interested parties, because it's in their interest that everyone knows about everybody else, because then you do create that sense of competition. But I think more realistically, they'll get between 1.5 and 2 billion. The government, I don't think, are simply, they're not going to allow Abramovich to set up a foundation that he controls, which the money's then paid into. They're not going to allow that to happen. So that's what, when I talked about this second license coming with restrictions, that will be one of the restrictions. Matt, I don't know what it's going to look like. I don't know what this payment model is going to look like. I don't know where the buyer is going to pay the money into. That is yet to be explained. And to be honest, I certainly, at the end of last week, I don't think anyone knew what that was going to look like. That's one of the things that they're working through at the moment. This is an unprecedented situation. But they have to, you know, as I say, I'm not suggesting for one second that Roman Abramovich would abuse that foundation and take that money for himself at a later date and not commit to paying money to the victims of war in Ukraine, which is the pledge that he made in that statement. But the government aren't just going to sit back and go, yeah, that's fine. Okay, yeah, that's what that looks like. you know, who knows where this foundation would be based? You know, is it based in London? Is it based in Israel? Is it based in Portugal? Is it based in Russia? So the idea that they're just going to allow, let's just say for argument's sake, Todd Bowley's consortium just to send £2 billion to a charitable foundation that a Roman Abramovich just set up, that's not going to happen.
Also, he did say net profits, didn't he? And I mean, it seems unthinkable in the current situation he's going to gain any profit at all. So quite how...
Well, it's net proceeds.
Net proceeds, yeah. So, but how, yeah, how that's sort of massaged by the government that, you know, obviously they can't be sending...
Well, yeah, absolutely. Again, he said in the statement that he would take nothing from it. And the club have backed that up. There was a point last week when I was talking to the club, and the person I was talking to at the club, Bruce Buck, the chairman, was standing there, and I was being guided. No, none of this money will go to Abramovich. He's written off the £1.5 billion loan that he's owed by the club. So once you've cleared the £58 million that they owe to creditors, and you've cleared and you've paid the fees, basically, you've paid the stamp duty, you've paid the Rain Group. You know, the way it was explained to me, if it was, for argument's sake, £2 billion, then most of that would go into this foundation. Now, as I say, that could still look like profit if Abramovich had control of that foundation. So that's what they've got to work out. You know, I don't know whether there's going to be some kind of almost like a holding bank, a holding account for this money. You know, the fact of the matter is every transaction that's done in the transfer market in English football, whether it's abroad or whatever, the money goes through the FA. So this is not unusual in football. So the money is paid to the FA and then it's paid on. You know, agents get paid through the FA. So there will be mechanisms where this can happen. And that is part of the control that the government now have, having frozen his assets here in the UK.
Matt, on Thursday, you argued in the Times that Roman Abramovich's arrival has transformed the game. So should his exit. You still feel the same way? Because I'm sure you must have had some reaction to that. And tell us exactly what you meant by it.
I mean, I don't think there's any doubt his arrival did. I mean, I think it's, you know, and I said, I think among many things, I mean, obviously there was just the impact of his signings, of what he did at Chelsea, but there was obviously huge wider ramifications of huge inflation in the game. I think he sort of became the poster boy of what could be done with club ownership. And obviously, you know, this was predating sovereign wealth funds coming in. But so, you know, we've seen a transformation of the model of ownership. And we've seen the idea come in of, we'll take the money wherever it comes from and we will ask questions afterwards. We've seen this escalation of sort of, you know, fans, you know, my owner's richer than your owner. You know, there's almost a sort of bragging rights about that. And obviously, you know, Chelsea playing Newcastle brought that to a head this weekend. And what I mean by transforming the exit, I think we're all asking huge questions now about the fact that we all just said, you know, we'll take the money wherever it comes from, or we'll ask questions afterwards, or we will just indulge in this ultra free market, ultra money based league. And I think I certainly am, and everyone I speak to is asking big, hard, very hard to answer questions about what is the alternative. How do you wean yourself off that model? How do you wean yourself off the money? And those are not, you know, Owen Slot, our colleague, wrote a piece on Saturday morning about, you know, do we look at the German model? But I mean, you know, to change models now is revolutionary. And I'm not suggesting I've got any easy answers. Obviously, there's the Tracy Crouch report that's still sort of being kicked around. We're waiting for government to come back on that. We're looking at whether a regulator makes a difference. But I think even Tracy would say that the regulations as stand Ukraine invasion would not have stopped Roman Abramovich buying the club any more than they'd have stopped Saudi Arabia buying the club. So if we want to put football clubs on a different footing and a different sort of viability from, you know, owning a company, an airline, a, you know, mansion in Knightsbridge, then that is going to take a whole lot of protections that we have never put around football clubs in this country. And that's That's a big thing to ask, but I think if we're not asking these questions now, then we never will.
If you accept that football clubs are different to owning an office block or whatever, that's what makes them very vulnerable to sports washing. And that means you do need completely different set of parameters when you assess who owns them. You can't be romantic about what football means to communities and how important it is to people. And it is. I mean, for some people, it is everything. And for some communities, it is desperately important. To then, we can't sort of shift 1 minute, say, well, it's a business, has to be profitable, you have to get people in, you've got lots of dosh. And on the other hand, say, it's not a normal business. There is more going on here. There is a reason certain people and organisations buy football clubs to either divert from what they do in the real world, or they want to appear more avuncular than they really are. And if you accept that football is being used, then you have to be just a bit more brutal about how you assess who owns them.
Also, I mean, let's be realistic. If we're going to, you know, look at this and look at it properly, because I think we can all talk about it and fret about it, but to actually, you know, expect that, you know, we would potentially put in protections around it, we might have to accept that it would no longer be the great global league that people have loved and thrived on. You know, if you make it much harder for rich people, wherever they come from, to buy football clubs, then the chances are, you know, we get sort of, you know, scaling down the operation, and it will not be the great cosmopolitan league, and we will not be richer than other leagues. And is that something we're willing to sacrifice? So, you know, it feels like a moment now. It's quite possible we've had moments before, and it could be one of those ones we chat about a lot, and then no one can come up with it. No one can agree, because this is the hardest thing. You know, this will take... None of this is easy. You know, Tracy Crouch's regulator report, and which stops a long way short of the type of things that Alice and I, you know, just alluded to, even that, which stops a long way short of that, is not something that just gets sort of brushed through, you know, 5 minutes. That's taking months, if not years, to bring to bear. So... That, you know, this is, you know, big existential, you know, debates, not just sort of stuff that gets, you know, football can't agree on anything at the best of times.
See, this is the only time, and I very rarely feel sorry for the Premier League, but listening to the radio over the weekend and hearing them so heavily criticised for allowing these owners, and it was coming from, of course, the game at Stamford Bridge between Chelsea and Newcastle, I felt, well, hold on a minute. Again, you know I love to criticise the Premier League, but... You're asking them as a commercial entity to take a stance and make a decision on who invests money into the clubs in English football that the UK government over the course of decades and longer hasn't taken on businesses in this country at all. They have in fact encouraged foreign investment wherever it is from, whatever question marks there might be over that money, into every sector, every industry, not just in football. And so football would sit back and say, well, are we holding ourselves back by saying no to these people when they're not being said no to in the legal sector, I don't know, or in the city or in Canary Wharf, wherever it might be. That money is... You know, it's given the red carpet. So it's you know, again, I would criticise them for not having stronger rules, and I wish they did have stronger rules, but they would be the sole entity, if you like, in this country saying no to, for example, Saudi investment. Our government doesn't have a problem with doing deals with people from Saudi Arabia. Why should football? That's what people will say.
But I think that's why, is why it's big issues about, you know, I don't think a morality test will work, for example, because, you know, and that's essentially what we're, you know, because, you know, everyone's going to have a different, you know, line in the sand that they would draw on morality. So I think you do have to look at the model. I mean, I think they say that's why Owen was right to raise the German example, because then you're talking about trying to create a model where there's some sort of consistency and some sort of idea that, you know, football clubs are as entities treated separately, rather than trying to do it as a case by case of, well, you know, we'll allow a Qatari owner, but we won't allow a Saudi owner. We'll allow a Saudi owner, but we won't allow a Russian owner or a China, you know, Chinese owner. So, you know, if you're trying to make those case by case decisions, we're going to tie ourselves in knots. So that's why I think this is a bigger issue than that. This is actually looking at the entire model of what we allow, you know, the, you know, say Owen obviously went into the whole sort of 50+1, you know, German idea of, you know, and even that's got holes and flaws in it, as we've seen.
If Newcastle were under that German model where it was effectively fan-led, they would have still backed the Saudi bid because they are obsessed with getting money in and being big at last.
Well, I think
over 80%, over was close to 90% of fans are very happy with what the model they've got now.
I think they were obsessed at it as well, Alison, because they'd had a taste of it before. Because in the 90s, they had Sir John Hall up there, and they were in the big league. They were beating Manchester United to Alan Shearer's signature. I still remember being on holiday and seeing £15 million for Alan Shearer. I couldn't believe it. I was like, £15 million for a footballer. But that was Newcastle United. They were in the big league. They know what it's like to be in there and to be able to get the best players and be signing people like Ginola and so on. And yeah, I think you're dead right. I think it would have been a stampede to get the Saudis to buy them if it had been up to the fans. And I think this ultimately, Hugh, is what's going on at Chelsea right now. Their biggest concern is that they're suddenly not going to be among this top tier of the super rich anymore. That's all they care about. You know, that is literally all they care about, and that's why you get these daft sort of statements being made by fans outside Stamford Bridge, where they're moaning about, you know, leave us alone. You know, it's purely because they're thinking, hang on a minute, we've been at the top table for 20 years. This could all end depending on who comes in.
Mm. Listen, I've always said that football clubs should be listed in some way for their cultural significance in our country. We know how significant football is. I remember looking for a house, and my partner sent me one in the Cotswolds, and it was a little cottage by a brook, and it was lovely. And it said, look, you can buy it, you can own it, but it's a 16th century cottage. You can't change it. You can't do anything to it. And honestly, you know, being over 6 foot, it was like going into one of the Hobbit's houses. I mean, I was like, I couldn't physically live there. And I don't think anyone knows that this little cottage exists. I mean, it doesn't have that level of significance, in my opinion. Maybe people in the Cotswolds will tell me differently. But these football clubs have huge significance. And the idea that we haven't in any way protected them, that we've in fact allowed a club to move from Wimbledon to Milton Keynes out of the heart of its community, shows that there has been an issue over the course of time with, I think, not protecting football clubs. And we could talk about it for a full hour. But I do want to move on to events at Stamford Bridge. Alison, I know that you were there. Chelsea hosting Newcastle, two Premier League clubs accused by many of sports washing. Newcastle's 80% owners, we know, the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia. Chelsea, of course, owned by Roman Abramovich, 100%. Both clubs deny any allegations of sports washing, of course. What was it like being there? How did you feel about the fixture?
Well, I went into the fixture thinking, well, this is significant, and I called it the ethics derby, and that's how it felt. There were nuanced points, and there were big, heavy slap you over the head points as well. There is still a flag talking about the Roman Empire written on a Russian flag. It's a very old flag, but you know, you do feel someone should have taken it down simply because it was Russian. Take it down, have some common sense and decency. But the atmosphere, and there were Saudi flags being flown in the away end, which, given it was one day after Saudi Arabia announced they'd executed 81 men in a single day, absolutely, people do not think about what they're doing, it seems to me. I mean, we're talking about the beauty of football and how important it is to a community, but it also allows people to completely switch off from the real world. And it just felt very crass indeed that nobody amongst the Newcastle contingent seemed to feel in any way embarrassed or have any deep thought about what that meant, that 81 men were killed in one day. And various human rights groups say those men were not given fair trials and some had been tortured. But let's fly the Saudi flag in the away end. Very strange. The game, the atmosphere, other than the Newcastle fans who did not shut up, the Chelsea fans were subdued, mostly. And the thing that was different, I've been going to Stamford Bridge for work for 27 years. I've seen games where Chelsea have been dominant. I've seen games where they have not. Seen all different types of atmospheres, felt different types of atmospheres, rather. When Kai Havertz scored in the 89th minute, after a game in which Newcastle looked perfectly, you know, capable of setting up to at least get a draw out of it, Chelsea were not really firing. If they don't have their first choice wing backs, they're not the best form generally. But, so they weren't playing that well. I'm pleased that Thomas Tuchel didn't try and pretend they weren't distracted by all the events we've been talking about, although he didn't say that was the entire excuse, but he said it was a factor. But when Kai Havertz scored a quite beautiful goal in the 89th minute, the noise that came from the fans, I have not heard that at the Bridge before. It was clearly, you know, relief. It wasn't joy. It was felt much more emotional, as though for that second, everybody who was there was releasing all their confusion about how they were supposed to feel about it. A lot of Chelsea fans I know are finding it difficult to be told they're supposed to now hate Roman Abramovich, having considered him for the past 19 years to be a largely avuncular presence who's learned as he's gone along, was the first to U-turn on the European Super League. He's an oligarch that they feel they have a connection with. He's always been very close to the players. He's always put the players first. They have built a relationship with him. And to be suddenly told everything for the past nearly 20 years they've been feeling is wrong to feel. And all that came out in that celebration of that goal. And it was, I'm not going to say it was moving. It wasn't moving. It was curious. And I did sort of feel, God, you know, it's very easy to pontificate about politics and rights and wrongs. But if you're a fan, you're having to grapple with changing your emotion, and that's not an easy thing to do.
You do mention that Newcastle's trip to Chelsea came on the day it was revealed 81 alleged members of a terrorist group, Al-Qaeda, of course, were ordered to be killed in a single day in Saudi Arabia. That is the largest mass execution in the country's history. Afterwards, the Newcastle manager, Eddie Howe, was asked about it. He said, "I'm here to manage the football team, coach the football team. I'm well aware of what's going on around the world, but my focus is on trying to produce the team to try and win football matches and get enough points to stay in the league. That's all I'll talk about." And we've had this debate around Thomas Tuchel recently as well, and the questions that were put to him over Abramovich. Fans are never happy with the journalists that ask these questions. Do you think journalists, Matt Dickinson, should be asking these questions to managers?
Absolutely. I mean, why not? I mean, it's, you know, people say, oh, keep the sport and politics separate. But I mean, I think anyone who's been arguing that has had a bit of an awakening in the last couple of weeks, haven't they? I mean, you know, we look at the situation at Chelsea. Of course, it's back to this point, though, of whether... I get who those colleagues of ours who asked those questions, I get why they did it. But the question is, are we going to keep doing this? Is this going to be a moment that we just sort of, everyone suddenly is alert to sports washing for 5 minutes, for a week, for two games, and then we move on quickly? Or are we going to actually look at this? Because, you know, Eddie Howe's answer was, you know, felt, shall we say, insufficient would be... will be the kind way of putting it, but it's not really about him, is it? It's not, you know, we're not going to fix the world just because Eddie Howe says, "I read about those executions and it was terrible," or, you know, comes out with a half-hour speech. You know, this is a bigger issue about what we were talked about before, about who owns our clubs, how we allow sports washing, what is that about? And so it's perfectly fair to ask Eddie Howe the question. It's fair to criticise him for the answer. But it's also a much bigger issue than Eddie Howe.
Matt Lawson, before you go, what did you make of Howe's responses? Did you expect more?
I didn't expect more, but I do think it's a fair question. I think anyone that has... See, whether it's Chelsea or Newcastle, I'm sympathetic to the people that were already there. I'm sympathetic to the Newcastle players who suddenly they have a different owner. It's circumstances beyond their control. And they may not be terribly comfortable with the fact that they're now being paid by the public investment fund in Saudi Arabia when they were previously being paid by Mike Ashley. And I'm sympathetic to some extent with the people at Chelsea because... it's only really become a massive issue since Putin chose to invade Ukraine. And now suddenly it's very uncomfortable. I thought David Walsh wrote a very good piece yesterday about the fact that, you know, it's unfair just to suddenly take a view of all Chelsea's success, you know, through a different through a different prism. You know, we weren't particularly questioning at the time. I know Matthew Syed routinely would write a very good piece about Abramovich, but for the most part, we all kind of accepted that there was Russian money there, and we all applauded when Drogba scored the winning penalty in Munich. But if you've chosen to go there and chosen to work there, I think tough if you keep getting asked these questions. I actually thought Eddie Howe got a pretty easy ride when he was unveiled as manager. I think Dan Ashworth, when he eventually rolls up at Newcastle, deserves to be grilled on it. Yeah, he had a very good job down at Brighton. He has gone to, and he's going to Newcastle. He's accepting the Saudi money. He's taken a massive pay rise from the Saudis. I think it becomes very difficult for them if they're going to continue to sort of support the Rainbow Laces campaign or other sort of human rights issues, and yet take the Saudi money. As I say, I think anyone that's chosen to go and work for Newcastle, these questions should keep coming. We should ask them every time it seems appropriate.
Right, Matt Lawton, thank you for being with us on the Game Podcast. It's literally on your bike to Matt. Off you go. Yeah. A bit of exercise.
Cheers.
In the morning.
See you later.
Appreciate it.
Bye,
take
everybody.
It easy. But I do want to continue the conversation with you, Alison, around the topic of sports washing, not just these two clubs, the allegation to levelled at, in particular, Manchester City and their Qatari owners. Of course, again, another club that denies any involvement in sports washing. But the answers from Eddie Howe, for me, the reason that they are so unpalatable compared to what Thomas Tuchel has been saying recently is, and I've said this previously around even Steve Bruce's answers around the Saudi owners when he was the Newcastle manager, he admitted there were questions to answer, he just didn't answer them. But what Eddie Howe does, which is so different and which basically underlines what sports washing is about, is that he will not acknowledge there is any issue whatsoever. And that's what sports washing to me is all about. We pretend it is all about football, all about the goals, all about the results, all about the beauty of the game, and there's nothing else going on. How did you feel about it?
Well, I was in the room and it felt uncomfortable because Eddie Howe said, I feel it's only right that I only talk about the football. And that's not saying I can only talk about the football. That's not saying I am restrained by the terms and conditions of my employment to only talk about the football. He's actually put a moral spin on it and said, I can only talk, it's only right that I talk about the football. And then that makes you think, oh my word, has he... I was sat there thinking, have you, Eddie Howe, when you were approached by Newcastle, who did you discuss it through with? And did you talk about the moral implications? Did you go, yippee, I'm getting paid a whopping great salary, bigger than I thought I was going to get at this stage of my career. I don't care where the money comes from. Or did you talk it through with people and say, should I take it? Do I feel conflicted? Are there ethical issues here? And Did he have those conversations and conclude there were no ethical issues? Did he conclude I can handle it when people think they can talk to me about non-on-the-pitch issues? Or is he so insensitive to it he doesn't care or even think about it? And any one of those outcomes makes him a lesser man, really. It's very strange that you would take the job. Was he so naive to think that it would die down after a few days? Does he not read, did he not investigate what the human rights record is of Saudi Arabia? Was he blinded? Is he genuinely think you can take a job in football and all you're doing is taking a job in football? You're not taking a job with an organisation who employ you. So he, by keeping his answers so, determinedly narrow, I feel it's only right I talk about the football. He's just making himself look one of various things, and none of those things are palatable, really.
It is a huge issue. These are questions that I think will continue to be asked at all of these clubs, in particular. If you are now raging at the Game Podcast, I can announce the woke virtue signalling is over, possibly. Can't make any promises for what's still to come. We will be talking about Cristiano Ronaldo and giving you some reasons to be cheerful as well, so you can smile a little bit. Stay with us on the game.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Right, before we leave the game podcast, it's time for some special mentions, some positivity. I mean, we you know, Everton fans, Chelsea fans, Newcastle fans, we're sorry. So we're going to give you something to smile about before the end of this podcast. In particular, Manchester United fans, you should be happy. You should be happy mainly, though, for Cristiano Ronaldo. He scored that hat-trick as Manchester United beat Spurs 3-2. Four-word match report. Two bang average teams. But the match was memorable, at least for Ronaldo becoming professional football's all-time top goal scorer with 807 goals by scoring that hat-trick. Somewhere, Pele is very unhappy, okay? I saw this headline and thought, is this right? But it's you know, the stats guys, the Guinness Book of Records, I don't know who, they've come to the conclusion that it's Ronaldo who is the greatest goal scorer ever. But is he the greatest striker ever? What would you say?
You know, when the debate used to be, you know, Messi v Ronaldo, I was on the camp of Messi because he just was more beautiful to watch, more aesthetically pleasing, and seemed quite humble in his general approach to his craft, whereas Ronaldo seemed to be creating the myth of Ronaldo as he went along and seemed far too self-aware. But of late, I've ended up really admiring him. And I can see why Tom Brady takes one look at him and says, oh, I'm inspired, I'm coming back, I want to be involved in this. It's amazing the way he looks 10 years younger than he is. He is an incredible physical specimen. His determination to score, his whole... The things about him I didn't used to like seem to be what makes him great and account for his longevity, I think. That sense of ego and entitlement and but three goals were lovely. He's a great finisher, and it's about his personality and his desire and determination to be the best player on the pitch. For some reason, I've gone full circle, and I just think, oh, actually, I think he's amazing.
And I look, it was great. You know, I saw the news come through and just thought, you know, there is a genuine wow of, you know, just when he's been written off again, or, you know, people think, oh, it's, you know, he's the fading force. He bounces back with that. But I think it's possible to go wow, to salute him, to salute his longevity, to salute all he's done and say, you know, was he what Man United needed for this season? You know, compared to someone to run a midfield, no, he wasn't. So, you know, I'm glad for the story of Ronaldo, that, you know, we've got another great chapter to it. But the fact is, you know, let's not pretend that it makes Man United suddenly look clever on that signing.
No, I would tend to agree with you on that one. But on Ronaldo, I saw a comment on Michael Jordan from one of his former Chicago Bulls teammates about the way that he treated everyone and how he wasn't everyone's friend in the changing room, and lots of his teammates didn't get along with him because he spoke to them in a certain way and pushed them in certain ways. And it was all about him, and he was very much... he wanted the rest of the team to be able to get the best out of him, and they all felt he was really self-centered, but in their years of retirement and the years that had gone by, they'd sort of understood why he was like that with them. And he was just a relentless winner. And the older Cristiano Ronaldo gets and the more I see of him, I'm starting to sense that, you know, it does come across outwardly as sort of that selfishness. But ultimately, if you know that you performing at your best is the quickest and easiest route to success, then maybe that's why you direct everyone in that direction. Anyway, just thought we had to mention him. Still a great of the game and always will be, and officially the greatest goal scorer ever, according to those that follow those sorts of things, not me. Listen, before we go, we did want to do some reasons to be cheerful, inspired by our friends at Times Radio. Hi, Matt Chorley. Reasons to be cheerful to end the podcast. What did you see this weekend that put a smile on your face?
Well, I was at Stamford Bridge. Two things. One was, as I said, the atmosphere was tense and difficult. But it was lifted when Antonio Rudiger decided to do his high-stepping, silly dance mid-match for no good reason at all, I think, other than to just break the tension. And he does that from time to time, does silly things, which is fantastic. On a personal note, I turned up to Stamford Bridge. I wasn't even sure. They're always so generous in the press box with the food. I thought, oh, I wonder if we'll get food. I wonder what would the impact be of the credit card freeze.
All the big things.
Yeah, big things. Because if I don't eat, I faint. So I brought lots of cakes with me just in case. And so I walked in. And of course, you know, as Tuchel pointed out, it's the people behind the scenes. You know, he's in a privileged position, but it's all the people connected to the club must be worrying about their salaries or their contract payments and so on. I walked in the press room and Brian, who mans the press room and has been doing it for the whole 27 years I've been going to Stamford Bridge, really lovely chap. The first thing he says is, oh, Alison, do you want me to look after your bike helmet? And so he puts it somewhere safe so no one tramples on it, so it remains safe and intact so that I can cycle home safely. And at the end of the game, he comes up to me to make sure he gives me back my bike helmet and then says, you know, don't forget it and cycle home safely. And you think, I went there with all sorts of preconceived worries about how people might be different, but no, they're just as behind the scenes, just as lovely.
Sports washing.
Sports washing by Brian.
This is the cozy face, you see. You're falling for it. If I can go fully self-indulgent, then I'll go... watching the joys of Luton Town versus QPR with family yesterday, and QPR won, which was stopping the rot after a wretched month. But they won with a goal that, were their VAR in the Championship, would have been disallowed for about 87 different reasons. So we were very much first of all, obviously celebrating the winner, but yeah, celebrating the fact that injustice rules in the Championship. I mean, and it's, yet again, it's another twist. I mean, if you look at the Championship table, basically there's about 10 teams that could get in the playoffs and go up via that route. And then I suspect that whichever one it is will be absolute cannon fodder next season. But who cares about that at this point?
It's more virtue signalling. I'm sorry, I told you I couldn't not go back to it before the end of the podcast. Emotional scenes at the London Stadium. Andrei Yarmolenko, of course, Ukrainian international, on the score sheet, back out on the pitch as well. That's his first West Ham appearance since the outbreak of war in his native country, and a very memorable Premier League moment. A huge moment for him, and it is a reason to be cheerful because he's back out there. He had been given some time off, of course, but again, to raise the awareness of what's going on. I'm sorry to virtue signal or be woke once again, but that was the standout moment for me this weekend. Is that all right?
It was a genuine moment. As you say, he's been, when David Moyes said he's had to have time off because obviously he was just completely preoccupied, as you would be with, you know, whether your family are being and friends are being blown up, then obviously it was very genuinely touching.
And I think, just to be serious for a minute, Yarmolenko obviously isn't the only Ukrainian who's been on the airwaves in Britain, but for the most part, they come on air and people from Ukraine will say, I want to thank the people of Britain for their support and all they're doing for us. And I'm sure they're not trying to be clever, but that is far, far more effective than them saying, we wish you'd do more, because it makes you feel, it does make you think, are we doing enough? Oh, they're thanking us. Why are they thanking us? I don't think we are doing enough. It's a better way into people's hearts to put pressure on the government to do the right thing.
And it was, again, a special moment. Alison, Matt, it has been fantastic to be with you on the podcast today. Our thanks to Matt Lawton, who joined us a little bit earlier on, and to all of you for listening as well. I hope you enjoyed yourselves. Remember, if you are, make sure you're subscribed. You can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times as well right now. Sign up. You'll get yourself 1 month free. So do check it out. It's thetimes.co.uk/thegame. We will be back on Thursday after more European football. See you then.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.